Hi, Katie here, just hopping on quick before the episode to remind you I am co-leading a pilgrimage to Ireland this coming October 2024. Come join me and Christy Eisinger on a magical tour through the Emerald Isle, Our Lady of Knock, St. Patrick's Holy Mountain, the Rock of Cashel, the Cliffs of Moher, ancient monasteries, high tea at a castle, traditional music, sheep herding demonstrations, a literary pub crawl. This trip has it all, and we've made sure to keep a pace that is both adventurous and relaxing, with time to explore on your own, make new friends, pray, eat, and travel carefree with the expert local guides provided by Select International. Check out the show notes to download the brochure and sign up today. Sláinte! Hi, I'm Katie Marquette, and you're listening to Born of Wonder.
And here there is something more than just a transient experience.
It's about being. It's about the things that matter to me. It's about the white spaces between the paragraphs.
Then God said, "Let there be light."
The mistake you always made, Doc, trying to love a wild thing.
Hello and welcome to Born of Wonder. I'm Katie Marquette, and on this podcast, we explore everything and anything that inspires wonder and awe in the world. I'm recording this little introduction the night before this podcast airs, so it's April 29th, and because this is a liturgically themed conversation, I looked up the saint of the day, and for April 29th, the saint is Saint Catherine of Siena. And I can't believe that I forgot that because St. Catherine of Siena is very, very important to me. I wrote my senior thesis in college all about her and her mystical treatise, The Dialogue. I also was not remotely religious at the time. So you can imagine just the sort of behind the scenes impact that this was having on me, just sort of poring over St. Catherine's life and her words and this sort of bizarre, wonderful, just beautiful theology espoused in the dialogue. And yes, St. Catherine is very important to me. So of course it would be her feast day when I am about to talk about, the importance of feast days and the importance of the liturgical year and everything that comes with it. That is one of the magical things as you start to learn about the liturgical year, is that oftentimes you will have these sort of kismet experiences of saint days falling on important days and certain, seasons coming up again and again that become very meaningful to you. And of course, when I'm talking about the liturgical year, I'm talking about the specific year that the church follows. We're talking about seasons like Advent and Eastertide, which we are in now, and Ordinary Time and Lent, these very important seasons that the church marks the year with, that we mark sort of the rhythm, the seasonal rhythm of the church with. And for most of us living in the 21st century, this is a very foreign idea, a very foreign concept. Even if you grew up in the Catholic faith or Anglican or any other, sort of denomination that honors the liturgical year, that celebrates these things, this is very, very rarely celebrated in a real way, in a embodied way, in a communal way, which is the way that the church did celebrate for centuries and centuries. This was the way that that people marked time. You'd date a letter not just with the date but with the feast day of whose saint's day it was, and people knew that, and there would be constant rotations of celebrations and seasonal remembrances and feast days, and everybody would be participating. Everybody in your community would be fasting for Lent and everything like that. Everybody would know exactly when you were, where you were in the liturgical year, because you lived in an infused Christian society. And that is obviously not the, largely secular, multicultural reality that we live today. So what do we make of this? Is there a place for the liturgical year in 2024? Are we just doing historical reenactment when we insist on celebrating feast days? I mean, what are we doing here? I'm going to tell you the answer is no. It's a lived reality. And to help explain that and to help root us and help us understand the history of these things and the beauty of them and the stories that come with them, I was really, really excited to talk to Kristen Hawkinson. I discovered her on Substack. She's a wonderful writer, amazing artist, and she has a great Substack called Hearthstone Fables. And she does these beautiful, beautiful newsletters celebrating liturgical seasons and feast days, and she really links them very specifically with agrarian traditions, with the seasons, just a really rooted, embodied way of encountering the liturgical year. And she does it in a very approachable way for somebody who's not familiar with any of these things. If you don't know even, you know, anything about the liturgical year, Kristen has amazing resources, and we're going to discuss all those things. We're going to talk about how to make this not just reenactment, but embodied reality. We're going to talk about, what about if you don't live in an agrarian community? If you live in the city, how can we root ourselves? How can we, celebrate these things? Because many of these feast days do have agrarian traditions around them, because most of human history was agrarian, largely, or at least had to be aware of those sort of planting, harvesting cycles in ways that we don't in a modern industrial world, right? But we all should become more aware of them, no matter where we're living, how we're living, and all these things just help us to stay rooted in our bodies and our faith. And it's beautiful. I'm so excited for you to listen to this conversation. So don't be intimidated by the liturgical calendar. It's something to learn as you go. It can be very, very small things. Tomorrow is the first day of May. Go and weave some flower crowns with your kids. You know, that's a great way to start the month. So I'll stop rambling. I'm just going to let us go right into the conversation here with Kristen. I was just so thrilled to have her on the podcast. She's living in on a multi-generational farm in the Pacific Northwest. She has a group called the Liturgical Ladies. I mean, that's amazing. I want to have my own Liturgical Ladies group. So let me know if you're interested, Liturgical Ladies. I was left feeling very inspired by this conversation and feeling like, celebrating with the rhythms of the church and the rhythms of the seasons was something that was accessible to me, that I wasn't overwhelmed by. So I think you will feel similarly. So I'll just remind you, as always, you can find me online at bornofwonder.com. Head on over to Substack, where I'm writing and sharing essays and podcast episodes and all those good things. And of course, follow the link in the show notes if you would like to join me and Christy Eisinger in Ireland this coming October 2024. We would so love to have you. Now that it's, within reach, like we're getting into summertime and then it'll be fall and then we're going to be jetting off to Ireland. I'm getting so excited. Like I think it's going to be really amazing. And I hope you look into it. If you've been thinking about it, just have a look. And if you have any questions, of course, email me anytime, marquettekatie@gmail.com. Okay, let's just get going on this great conversation I had with Kristen Hawkinson. Today, I am so excited to be joined by Kristen Hawkinson, who I have had a Substack crush on for quite a while now, following her amazing publication all about the liturgical year and the agrarian year. She's talking to us from her farm in the Pacific Northwest. And Kristen, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the whole mission of what you're doing in your podcast, and I've already learned so much from it. So it's been really exciting to cross paths with you. As another Instagram crush. Or Substack crush.
Substack crush. Yeah, I know. Which platform are we on?
Yeah. I know. Social media, yeah.
Who can keep up? But okay, so Kristen, I know you from your publication, but I really don't know a lot about your background, and I'd love for you to introduce yourself to our listeners. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, your day-to-day life, your religious background, just what you do?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Montana. So that's where I spent most of my formative years. And then I moved out to Washington State to go to college, and I majored in classical studies. So Greco-Roman civilization and language. with a real emphasis on the Roman Civil War and looking at that period and all the aftermath of the Civil War. And then that was where I met my husband, was in college. My husband, David, grew up on this little farm, a little family farm, just like 45 minutes east of Seattle. And so after college, we ended up coming back to the farm, working on it for me for the first time. For him, it was returning and then managing it, and then bought it from his dad years ago. So now we have three generations living on the farm, which feels a little bit like, in our modern era, it feels a little bit like a holy grail.
In our modern age, I think any sort of intergenerational living is pretty unique. And it's very unique to have that going on in an agrarian setting. I think that that's something I think we all romanticize. Is it as romantic as we imagine? I'm sure it's a lot more difficult as than we imagine too.
Yeah, no, it has its romantic elements, but it also has its real elements. So yeah, the reality is very much present. But I think a big part of the benefit of this kind of thing, besides just the interpersonal element of the people, is that if you want to make any positive changes in agriculture and in the land, that necessitates a multi-generational approach. Because what we do is not going to be able to just solve issues right here and now for talking about soil fertility and things like that. We need to be thinking what this is going to be like for our children. Not that we're like going to force our kids to farm or something, but we want them to feel positive about it and want it to be a place that feels like an option. And I think that for a lot of generations, it no longer felt that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like is it like a Native American saying where it's like any decision you make should be with five generations ahead in mind or something like that? I don't remember
exactly. Yeah. I think it's, the seventh generation or something. Yeah,
seventh generation. Exactly. That's right. Yeah. And that's such a like foreign concept, I think, to the modern mind, because we are very like, what's in front of us now? What works now? Not thinking ahead. So it's a very different dynamic for sure. So obviously you're very familiar with the agrarian seasonal shifts going on, but were you always familiar with the liturgical season? I'm a Catholic convert as of 6 years ago now. So I'm still always constantly learning the liturgical year. It's not something that is natural to me. But as I talk to people, I learn it's even for cradle Catholics, it's not, or Anglicans or other people who celebrate within liturgical seasons, it's really not that practiced a lot in modern religious tradition. So is this something that you knew all about, or is this something you adopted later on in life?
This was something I adopted later on in life. To go back to your intro question too, I was not raised going to church. I was raised in a very reverent household, but my parents, like so many people, got burned by a lot of the elements of institutionalized Christianity during that time. It's a common story, but I was raised with a lot of respect for it. My parents came from Lutheran and Catholic traditions. So I grew up with a lot of friendliness toward faith, but without that experience. So I knew Christmas and Easter. I did not really know any of the points of connection in between them. And it wasn't until, probably I was pregnant with our first kiddo or something, when I first encountered the liturgical calendar, that is to say beyond Christmas and Easter. And so I was reading a book. It was like an introductory book for a college medieval studies course that my husband had taken and had saved that book. So it's just a little guy. It's called A Medieval Life by Judith Bennett. And it takes a real historical medieval peasant and it walks through her life, partially using historical evidence, hard evidence, and then teasing out some ideas of what would her daily life have looked like. And it was the chapter on the ritual year where I was like, it was that Wizard of Oz moment where everything goes technicolor. And I saw this context for these calendar celebrations that I had never seen before. And in particular, they were talking about, and it was very surface level, just a quick run through of the calendar. But when they were talking about Candlemas, and I saw the connection between Candlemas and Christmas, and the beauty of engaging all of the senses and of the way the calendar really moved with the natural seasons, that just really took me by surprise. And it was a big part of my conversion, really.
Yeah, I think that certainly not at the level, I'm much more ignorant about these things than you are, but in those little ways, Candlemass was one of them for me too. It was always just so beautiful to me to see these reflections, and even just like with Easter celebrations, renewal, like spring, resurrection is reflected in the natural world. And you do see these things, and connecting them, I think, makes it that much more powerful, that it's a very lived experience. And I think the fact that this was about the medieval world, that certainly, I think that was a time, there have been before and since, but when religion was so integrated into the day-to-day life that it was, I often feel like we have to put on this experience. Like, it's such like an effort to be like, okay, what feast day is it? What is going on? But for the medieval person, it was like the air you breathe, right? It was like, oh, it's Monday. And you'd also just know what feast day it was. It was like, and all your neighbors would be doing that too. Do you find that like living the liturgical year, I don't want to say in isolation, because of course we are part of the bigger church, but sometimes it still feels like that. It feels like celebrating the liturgical year in isolation can be difficult. Do you find that? Does it feel like you're celebrating in isolation sometimes?
Yes, it does. And what I've been doing is I've been working in response to that to see what does this look like in our modern context? It's really easy to romanticize the way it used to be, because I do love that intertwining, like you said, in the Middle Ages, for all of its foibles, there was this really beautiful intertwining of the sacred and the secular, just in daily life, where somebody's churning butter and they're saying a prayer. And so it sometimes feels nowadays like it's easy to turn all of these different feast days into a museum collection that I'm curating. Even when I'm celebrating it, it can feel a little bit like historical reenactment. And actually, so out where we live, weirdly enough, 10 minutes away from us is a medieval village. It's a living history. Yeah, I know.
There is.
Of course. Yeah. So it's a living history museum. And they follow the liturgical calendar, of course. And they really are reenacting. And it's an educational thing. And I love that. And I think there's a lot to be learned from it. But I'm also looking for the spiritual meat and potatoes of how is this actually communicating the message of Christ in my life and in the lives of my neighbors. I tend to be really detail oriented, and I will go down these rabbit holes and not come up for air. And I've been trying to balance that with the social aspect, because even if you go to a church, even if you're part of a denomination that follows the liturgical calendar, it's usually only in lectionary form. Rarely do you really see a lot of the engagement with a holistic approach to the liturgical aspects. You'll get the readings, you'll get the liturgical colors, that kind of thing. But all the rest, from talking to a lot of people anyway, that's the impression I get, that it's not just my own perception that it's that way. So for several years now, I've hosted a group. We call it Liturgical Ladies, although the guys and the kids, everybody's welcome. And the goal in that has been, we draw people from a lot of different churches. We get together about once a month and we celebrate a feast day. And a lot of it is looking at those grassroots aspects of, what does this actually look like in community? What does this actually look like? Not as a historical reenactment, but to say, what is the driving force behind all of these different traditions? Like rush bearing is an example. I get really excited about rush bearing in the summer, which was one of those grassroots liturgical festivals that's not based in lectionary tradition, but rather from the needs of the church and of the parish, of spreading rushes on the floor because they didn't have flooring at the time. It was just dirt. And so I had the challenge.
What is it? I don't know.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I'll send you pictures. It's so good. What they would do, since they just had these dirt floors, is they would go and collect rushes, which are like tall, marshy grasses and stuff. Or depending on where they were, where the parish was, that would just be hay or something like that. And they would make a big ceremony and a big procession of collecting the rushes. There would be like a rush cart sometimes that's decorated with these bundles of rushes. And they would parade them to the church and they would spread them on the floor. And they'd mix them in with like aromatic herbs and flowers and stuff for pest control. So to take a tradition like that was once such a crucial part of parish life and then say, what does it look like now? Like, how can that be a meaningful part of our own traditions? I feel like so much of modern worship, I never connected with. And I think that's part of the reason why when I found the liturgical calendar, that was the mode of communication from Christ that managed to convert my heart in a lot of ways. Because I'm a creature that loves stories.
Yeah.
And give me a story, give me a taste and a scent and all of these things, and I will start to see this whole picture in new ways.
Yeah. And, you know, that element of story, too, I think is so compelling for kids. Like, I think that the liturgical year is obviously so rich for family traditions and things like that. Like, so many of us, we do, as you say, Christmas and Easter, like, that was my background as well. But even within my basically secular family, we would often still go to a midnight church service or something like that. And that left a huge, like, impression on me as a kid, even as a non-Christian family, just from the, like, beauty of it and the ritual of it and the traditions around it. So to take that and think, we have a whole year of that to explore and give to our kids. And obviously, not to overwhelm any parents, you don't have to do everything like Christmas and Easter, but that there are these little just really fun things. I think we'll talk about this a little bit later, but like doing like May Day crowning of Mary and little things like that are so fun to incorporate little kids with and things. Yeah, even like my toddler, like we have a painting of St. George, like killing the dragon. And we never even talked about it except to just ask. She's asked who it was. And we said it was St. George. And she came to me in the barn the other day with a broom in one hand. And she was like riding a stick with the other one and I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm St. George, like killing the dragon. And I was like, oh my goodness. So it's like having these little things around. And now she's so excited to celebrate St. George's feast day. We're recording this the week of his feast day. But so I think it's great for families and everything. But little aside there, but I want to talk very specifically about how you're sharing about this, which is primarily through Hearthstone Fables, which is your Substack, your Instagram, your shop, everything, where you're sharing this beautiful combination of art, poetry, literature, connecting the liturgical year and the seasons. You're a very talented artist. I'd love to learn more about your artistic background. Were you always an artist? And did you immediately make that association of creating art for the liturgical year? Just how you're bringing in all these interests and passions to share the liturgical year.
Thank you so much. I did not really grow up with any formal training in art. I just always loved drawing. I would always be sketching. When The Lion King came out, I was always drawing lions. So I really gravitated toward drawing animals. And that has just stuck with me always. My grandmother was, she did rose mailing, I think it's called. It's that Scandinavian style of painting. I think it's mostly Swedish. It would be on wood or on tin and it would be folk art. For a while, what I did is I painted big, I painted a little bit more abstract, and then hung in galleries. And then when our first child was born, I really switched gears and wanted to do something that I could do during nap time or do on my lap. Mm. And so if I switched to something smaller, more watercolor illustration, that was something that I could do. Oh, he woke up early. I can just let this dry and then get back to it later. And then folding the liturgical art into it, I've always gravitated toward painting the seasons, painting animals and plants. And there was this book that I had found years ago. I don't remember the author's name right now, but it's Signs and Symbols in Christian Art, I think is what it's called. And it's like just a little introductory dictionary type resource where it goes through Christian art over the years, a lot of Renaissance paintings, and it pieces out all of the symbolism in the paintings. So when you see a painting and little baby Jesus is holding a peach or something like that, means something. Every bird, every plant, every single specific thing is communicating a message. And you think about, especially in that historical context where people didn't always have the ability to read, they had a visual catechism. They had something that could send a message to them A picture's worth a thousand words, I think. So if they saw an iris, they would automatically be reminded of Mary and be reminded of her sorrows. So it's also not a hard and fast rule. Like all of these plants also, they can mean something beautiful. They can mean something terrible. It can really span the spectrum. It's not a science. Mm-hmm. But when I saw that, I just saw so much potential in it for taking what I was already doing of working with the images of plants and animals and then looking at all of the historical meaning in them that does morph a lot throughout the years. So that's what I draw into my artwork. Oh, there's a pun. So I like to incorporate symbols like that. So particular birds, plants, animals, whatever it is that can communicate that message.
A while ago, I interviewed Grace Hammond, who wrote the book Jesus Through Medieval Eyes, and it's a great book.
I love Grace.
I know, she's so great. Yeah. And she really emphasizes in the book and in the interview I did with her that, yeah, for a medieval person, symbolism and metaphor and like understanding the stained glass was not just beautiful. It was the way they were learning the story of Christianity. This was, most of them were not reading the Bible themselves. They were hearing it in church, but a lot of times it's not even in English. This was art was the way that people were learning about the faith. I love that you're bringing in that sort of that tradition. And I sometimes our own, just like I live in the countryside and I still am so ignorant of so many plants and things like that. I walk around with my little plant app and try to learn them, but we just don't have this inherited wisdom anymore that we would have learned. So I love that you're bringing that back. And I think it's so compelling and so beautiful. And so in the tradition of the liturgical year, to be using not just words, but art and using other senses to engage people. So you also, in addition to Hearthstone Fables, you founded and co-edit Signs and Seasons, which is so great. And I just would love for you to tell our listeners a little more about that publication as well.
Yes, I added that with Dixie Dillon Lane and Sarah Dietz. And the goal of that publication was to provide an ecumenical platform on Substack, although we feature articles that are both on and off of Substack, but where people who are interested in the liturgical year, they're curious about it, they're well-formed in it, spanning the spectrum, where they can encounter each other's ideas, learn things, ask questions, that kind of thing. Because like I said, for me, the liturgical calendar has been really profound in communicating Christ. And I also know that the way I reflect it and the way I approach it is going to inherently be a barrier and a boundary for people who are like, I'm not interested in history. I don't like cooking. I don't like crafts, whatever it is. That's fine. There are just so many different ways of approaching the calendar, of celebrating its cycles. And I wanted Signs and Seasons to be a space where that can become apparent. So you don't like baking, that's fine. Here are a lot of other ways to do it. It is really a versatile and a flexible thing. It's a living, breathing thing in a lot of ways that changes over time. And it's important to me that other voices can have an opportunity to intersect and interact with each other and learn from each other.
Mm-hmm. And I think that publication would probably be a great place for somebody who does want to learn, is overwhelmed at the prospect of the liturgical year, but because it is overwhelming, especially if you come in not really knowing anything at all. But I think you guys do a really good job of bringing in, it's very accessible. And like you say, there's these different voices and different angles about how you can approach different seasons and root yourself in this tradition. So I would recommend people check it out. Of course, everything, all the links will be in the show notes. So let's get into some specifics about the liturgical year. You mentioned earlier like Candlemas, but are there some maybe other examples you could give of times when, you know, in your agrarian lifestyle, you see just how fit together the liturgical year and the natural seasons go together? Could you maybe give an example or two of that?
Yeah. So one example that really comes to mind for me is Halloween, my favorite holiday. They're all my favorites,
Halloween,
I guess.
Too. I love it.
It's starting to get more love lately. So
I have a Memento Mori sweatshirt with a skull on it. So I'm
Where can I get a matching one? What I need to
bring house.
I need the uniform.
I love it. Yeah, I recommend. That's awesome. Yeah, I like to just, I wear that all year. It's like Christmas. I'm like, memento mori. So yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Halloween. It's an everyday shirt. No, I love that. And one of our kids was actually born on Halloween, coincidentally. Just amazing. I always loved Halloween. I did not understand the meaning of it growing up and stuff. It was a standalone thing for me, but I loved the mysterious spookiness of it. And then when I moved out to the farm, my husband had grown up with this, so this was familiar to him, but we do a big pumpkin season on the farm. So usually we're a CSA, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture, where people will buy a share of produce and they'll come pick it up weekly during the summer. We do depot delivery the rest of the year. And then in October, we open up our pumpkin patches and we do harvest festivals. And it is just 7 days a week of pumpkins, which is very fun. But by the end of it, by the time Halloween comes, it feels like New Year's Eve. And when you start to look at a lot of the calendar traditions, you also start to see that shift in the calendar where All Saints Day is like New Year's Day in some regions. And calendars get really funny. I should also mention that my approach to the liturgical calendar is very ecumenical, not because I want to treat it like a salad bar, but because like in the 1960s, the vigil for All Saints, Halloween, was removed from the calendar in the Roman tradition. So I like to borrow a little bit here and there. But that for me, when I experienced that sensation of, wow, this really is the end of the growing season. And now we are moving into winter. And I saw that align with the cycle of feasts in the calendar. I felt that distinctly. And then another big piece is having Christmas placed at the winter solstice and then having the Feast of St. John the Baptist, the Nativity, set at midsummer, 6 months earlier. So they're like these twin stars. And I had never noticed this before, but seeing that reflection in the work we do on the farm, where John says, I must decrease, he must increase. And that reflected in the sunlight. You start to see and feel a seasonal shift happening as the sunlight is decreasing after his feast. And then the same in the winter solstice, when especially out here in the Pacific Northwest, it is dark all the time. And you begin to see the days lengthen a little bit. And in the Middle Ages, I think they saw this as being not exactly metaphorical, like divinely metaphorical, not a human metaphor, but that yes, all of these things really are underscoring the greater message of the arc of Christ's life and salvific work.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I hadn't thought about John the Baptist. I didn't make that connection. That's really awesome. I love that. And even just like you think about if Christ's birth aligning with the darkest point in the year and all the associations of following the star and everything like that. But then it's like from Christ's coming, it's like lighter every day. It's like that light increases from his birth.
Yeah.
That's so beautiful. And I think I really try to stay in tune with the natural year. I try to live seasonally. I try to like hibernate more in the winter and respect sort of our body's need for seasonal rhythms as well. But I think so many of us we're so divorced from that. So I also love that in really observing the liturgical year, we can actually ground ourselves even more in the seasonal year as well, and in our bodies and in all these things that we are like body and soul, and that we need that balance in our lives. It's just so lacking.
Yeah, the liturgical year is really, it's such a sacramental approach. And I know it might not by definition be like a capital S sacrament or sacramental, but it is acknowledging and affirming our incarnational reality that we are body and soul. We do need rest. We do need to have seasons and allow that for ourselves. So I tend to struggle with seasonality big time. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm so drawn to seasonality, because I need to train myself toward that. And I think that's what the calendar helps me to do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we all need some help with that. I know, because we've got our laptops, we've got our ability to just keep going all the time. So it is hard. So let's ground us a little bit to where we are right now. This episode is going to air on the last day of April, it looks like at this point. So perfect for listeners ready to dive into the new month and some new liturgical and seasonal traditions in May. So can you orient us a little bit where we are? I pretty much know that it's spring. It's still Eastertide, right? I think so. And that's about all I know. So I would love to be a little more rooted in where we are and what we can look forward to coming up.
Sure. As usual, I have a complicated answer or complicated perspective. In terms of the seasonal year, the natural seasons, we're in spring. It can get a little dicey because you have astronomical seasons and you have meteorological seasons. And calendars are also very subjective. They've changed a lot over time and by culture and region and things like that. But historically, you would look at the spring equinox as being the center of spring, and that really early spring was the beginning of February. So Candlemas, when you start to see little bells, Candlemas bells coming up out of the soil, right? And then spring would be ending around the beginning of May. But by our modern reckoning, spring goes right up until the summer solstice. So the reason the summer solstice is called midsummer is because it used to be classed as midsummer, the actual midpoint of summer. So yeah, we're in spring and we are in Eastertide, which is a 50-day season. And let's see, where are we? I think we had the fourth Sunday of Easter and we're moving toward the Ascension, which is a really beautiful tradition. And it always lands on a Thursday. I think some denominations celebrate it on a Sunday, but that's 40 days after Easter. And it celebrates the Ascension of Jesus, which was also, that was a whole thing for his community because he resurrects, he comes back, he's returning, he's walking among them. And now the Ascension occurs. And then 10 days pass between the Ascension and the Feast of Pentecost, when Mary and all of the disciples are gathering for what was a Jewish feast. It was a feast of first fruits to get ready for the upcoming growing season and harvest. So they were gathering for that. And that's when the tongues of flame happen and the Holy Spirit descends. And that then moves us into ordinary time, the second part of ordinary time.
And then it won't be until Advent that we're back into another,
with Easter being early this year. That's a whole, the reckoning of Easter, the time reckoning of that has always been a long debated thing, but it felt a little bit early this year. Sometimes it just feels way. And then we have this long stretch of ordinary time that goes all the way up until the first Sunday of Advent. And I know a lot of times ordinary time can feel like you're just swimming out there. There's no huge feasts or anything. But honestly, it has come to be my favorite season. You get the feast of St. John the Baptist, which is, we only celebrate three nativities in the calendar. Jesus, John the Baptist, and Mary's nativity, which is in September. The feast of St. John used to be, and I think in some Scandinavian countries, they even call it like a little Christmas. Like it was the summer Christmas. And instead of evergreen trees, they would have birch trees. And it's just so beautiful. So we have that. And we have, oh gosh, we've got like St. James Day, which is a really fun one in July. And of course, things like Halloween. I love Hallowtide.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. There is a lot to look forward to. And I think we often dismiss ordinary time as, okay, we're just, that's it. Wait till Advent.
Just treading water.
Going again. I feel like this is ordinary times when I feel like during Advent or Lent, I'm like, okay, I gotta like go to adoration or confession or something. Like I feel that because I have a feast day on the horizon, but maybe we could all adopt more reverence for St. John's feast day and things like that, that we can orient us a little bit more toward a rhythm within ordinary time as well. So what about like in May here, do we have any like special traditions coming up that maybe listeners could look into to celebrate with their families?
Yeah, so we have May Day. So like you said, the crowning of Mary is always a big one. So at our farm, we do a May Day celebration with a maypole and everything, where we harvested a tree that was ready to fall down up on the hill. And that's our maypole. So that's really magical. And then May 3rd is the invention of the cross, which celebrates St. Helena, who is the mother of Constantine when she found a piece of the cross, is how the story goes. I think it's celebrated in September sometimes too. That has some fun traditions. We have the Ascension, which I think partially because the Ascension involves this imagery of Jesus moving up to the heavens. That is where a lot of traditions came that involved anything having to do with rainfall. So he's moving up to the heavens. There's a lot of clouds and stuff in the imagery. And you think of the rain coming down as well as the growing season, because these things are so intertwined. So a lot of picnics, a lot of blessing of holy wells, blessing of water, things like that. The Rogation days precede the Ascension. And those are the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday preceding Ascension. And I love them. That's another example of kind of an older tradition where you have to ask, how do we do this now? And Rogation comes from the Latin rogare, which means to ask. So it's a time of petitioning, a very agricultural tradition, because it's a lot of, gosh, we sure hope that these seeds sprout because we need to eat. And so actually, this past weekend, our liturgical ladies group celebrated the feast of Saint Mark, which is coming up from the recording of this on April 25th, which also coincides with the major Rogation day. And that Rogation involved walking parish boundaries and getting a sense of what the boundaries were, especially for children in those ancient times, was really important. And then praying a litany throughout this process. So it really is this posture, aligning your posture toward God, toward your neighbor, and toward your landscape. So when our liturgical ladies group met to celebrate St. Mark's Day, we did some of those rogation activities where I sent all the kids out to a field we just planted with peas. And they all had kites and things. We were like, go bless the field. And they just ran around the field everywhere and played. And it was beautiful. Yeah, the Rogation days are coming up. And then, and then we have Pentecost, which is another exciting little holiday that is, again, like a lot of picnics, a lot of just enjoying being outdoors. And the whole month of May is very Marian. We're not really sure why. When you look at the derivation of that, it seems like a lot of the Greco-Roman goddesses tended to be honored during May. So it's possible that this has to do with that. But I think the queenship of Mary used to be celebrated at the end of the month. I think it's the visitation now. It changes a lot.
Yeah,
I think that it is important. It's like such a tension all the time between like keeping traditions, but also recognizing that this is a living tradition. And so it, as tempting as it is to be like mourning sometimes, oh, I wish we did it like the medieval people did it. We're not medieval people. There's something to be like, how do I make this a living tradition, as we were saying at the beginning, versus a historical reenactment. And I think that can be like being okay with like things change and that's okay, but let's make this work for us. So like, you live in this agrarian setting, so I think this lends itself very well, and I do too, so I'm going to be following your lead. But a lot of people live in urban areas, or they live in the suburbs or something, and maybe there's no field for them to send their kids to go run around. They're not going to send them out into the city streets or something. How is this something that we can still feel rooted in modernity and in more urban settings? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, and that can be a hard one, because when you look at the formation of the liturgical calendar and you see how it is this accumulation of wisdom and experience and tradition over just so many centuries, you see the top-down influence, that is to say, like the theological informing of tradition that's coming from institutions. And then you also get the bottom-up, which is the grassroots tradition. And that's where we end up with holidays like the Assumption getting blended into the calendar, which was really a popular devotion for a long time and then became part of the official calendar. But by virtue of all of those grassroots traditions coming from what was historically agricultural societies up until the Industrial Revolution, really changes the dynamic for a lot of families. so many of these traditions are just inherently agricultural. So if somebody is just living in an urban setting and they are trying to read more about the liturgical calendar, they're going to encounter a lot of that. And that can probably feel a little bit off-putting. Like, how do I possibly connect with this if I'm living in an apartment in New York City or something like that? And I do think that to me, the wisdom to distill out of it is an approach toward our lives in a way where we're paying careful attention, just a posture of attentiveness. And even if we're living in a really urban setting and we just don't have access to a field to run around, which is in our day and age is a huge privilege, whereas it was once the norm, I think the art of noticing and of embracing some form of localism as much as that's possible. And I realize that, again, there's a lot of issues in the modern day where localism has become the purview of privilege in many ways, just because the cards are stacked against it in agriculture, right? So if you're in an urban setting and you can find a local farmer's market, or you can find a local urban garden or a farm or something like that, it can give you a better sense of what food is available that is traveling a shorter distance. And then look at how that intersects with the calendar in that moment. Or even just noticing the weather, just keeping a weather journal and looking at what the clouds are doing, the different cloud formations, temperature, humidity. It can sound a little bit goofy, but when you start to track that and you track it alongside what's happening in the liturgical calendar, you can begin to see those alignments, like we were talking about with the birth of Christ landing at the winter solstice and the birth of the Baptist landing at the summer solstice. And so there's a gal on Substack named Steph who lives in the Southern Hemisphere. She lives in South Africa. And it's been really interesting talking to her because their seasons are also flipped. And so one of the cool things that we were talking about was how, like, my way of approaching the calendar tends to be to look at all of these historical elements, all of these ways that people celebrated these holidays, and then distill from it what I can use. And that means a combination of heritage with a combination of what is local to me. So for instance, for St. Mark's Day coming up, he's the patron saint of Venice. So I'm making a risotto, but I'm using some stinging nettle that I gather just on our hillside and some green garlic that's out in the field that hasn't bulbed out yet. I'm taking what I have locally and applying it to the universal calendar. Because I think that, and this is one of the beautiful things for people who are living in urban settings, is that the calendar is so regionally based. And we don't think of it that way in the internet age, because it's like drinking from a fire hose. You look up liturgical calendar and it's, oh my goodness, there are 15 saints on every single day. How do I do this? How do I find a holy well? What do I do? But traditionally, there were universal feasts, but there were a lot of regional feasts. So if there was a patron saint to a particular area, there would be a big devotion to that saint. And then a lot of the food, a lot of the tradition that now we see coming down the line through history is very regional and tied to that specific place because of that devotion. So we don't need to do it all. Mm-hmm. But we can find ways of saying, okay, in my region of this urban setting in New York City, what does the liturgical calendar look like? What does St. Mark's Day look like in terms of the animal life I'm seeing, things like that? Just noticing. I think it trains us to notice, which speaking of myself, I'm out of practice at, but I think a lot of us struggle with.
That's a good point too about the regional aspect, because if you're in an urban setting, you probably, one of the great advantages is urban parishes are often very dynamic and interesting. And I still miss going to my urban parish. We went to the Basilica of the Assumption and they would have a huge Assumption party every year on the lawn. And there were lots of things like that that were tied to the history of that cathedral or basilica rather. And they, I bet for a lot of people, maybe their individual parish, like what saint or who is your parish devoted to? You could nudge your priest or something and say, you know, maybe we should make more of a thing of this. And, you know, just because you aren't out farming every day, you certainly, like you say, can be rooted in the weather and the changing seasons. And there's still a lot of ways to be very rooted in your environment. We had friends who would often do like walking rosaries from like Wednesday, pick one church in the city and walk to another church and just pray the rosary as they go along. Like there are lots of ways to be in your urban location in a rooted way. And I do think that is oriented toward attention, which we can do wherever we are. Yeah. But also I do think good to acknowledge and note that you may be reading along and be like, a lot of this is about crops. It's okay. Like realize that you may have to get a little more creative, but certainly can be done. So just as we're wrapping up here, we've already talked about a few, but I do want to give you a chance if we haven't brought one up, if there was any like specific tradition in all this time you've been researching this, if there's one that you just like love so much and wish more people knew about. You've already brought up some great ones that you may have already mentioned when you were thinking of, but if there were any others.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm always like, oh, this one is my favorite. Oh, this one too is my favorite. I just love them all. So I think the Annunciation is really exciting because it's not really, does your parish celebrate the Annunciation?
Not like particularly noted.
Yeah. Right. Noted. Yeah. But it used to be a really big celebration and it was actually New Year's Day for a long time. New Year's Day is an interesting thing. It gets moved around a lot, but where it celebrates the conception of Jesus and Mary's fiat. But it was just this really potent day where in medieval tradition, they believed that the Annunciation, the conception of Jesus occurred on the same day as his death. And that was really important within the context of Christianity and Jewish tradition, because a lot of times leader in the Jewish tradition, a rabbi would maybe be, or a prophet would be born and died on the same day. It was like an alpha and omega moment then on the Annunciation. So I don't worry about was this literally true or not. To me, the kind of the meaning in this that's grounding that notion is really beautiful. So that's where you'll get, I think it was specific to England. There will be some churches where there are images of Christ crucified on a lily because the lily is symbolic of the Annunciation and yet there he is crucified on it. It was also considered to be the first day of creation overall. That was the first day of God's creative act, was the Annunciation date of March 25th, which also by the old calendar would have been the exact date of the spring equinox. In our modern calendar, the equinox has ended up bumped up a few days, but that coinciding of the Annunciation of Jesus with the spring equinox is just so powerful when you start to realize all the layers to that cake.
Yeah, that is beautiful. I'm glad to know that one of my daughter's birthdays is March 24th, so very close to that. So that's a beautiful thing to know for that week there. Cool. Yeah, I think that is one of the poetry of this, of our tradition, is something that I think just comes through so much. And I hope that people will look more into it, because if you have a literary, artistic mind, it's like just so exciting, and it really just allows you to fall into the beautiful story of faith as well as the practical aspects of it, of practicing this faith. It's such a beautiful story. I think that allows us to appreciate that more. So Chris, I could keep picking your brain, but I will respect your time and wrap up here. But I did want to ask you, I often ask guests, is there something that is bringing wonder in your life currently? A book, a song, the seasons, anything? Yeah, just anything on your mind.
Oh, gosh. So I've been reading a book by Diane Akerman called A Natural History of the Senses. And that has been very fascinating. She's just moving through each of the senses and talking about cultural context with them, just the biology of the senses and all of this. And I keep coming out of it being like, oh my gosh, did you know this about that? It's just incredible.
That's great. That fits so perfectly into, as we're trying to root ourselves here in our bodies and the seasons and time and the liturgical year, how often do we just forget that we're like a breathing person? Sometimes we're just like typing away and we just forget. Oh yeah, like I have eyes and senses. So thank you for that. I will look that book up and put it in the show notes. So I'm sure people will want to follow along with what you are doing. Where is the best place to find all the exciting things you're doing online?
So I'm on Substack at hearthstonefables.com. And I'm also on Instagram. You know the struggles there. But yeah, I'm a little hit and miss online sometimes, but you can find me, you can email me, get in touch if you want to chat more. Yeah, I love the liturgical calendar and I welcome input and ideas and suggestions for celebrating it.
Great. And you have a wonderful archive to explore. People can just head over to your Substack. And I think when I checked out your about page, you very nicely have it organized according to season and everything. So there's going to be so much for people to explore there. I will put all the links in the show notes. Kristen, thank you so much for taking the time. I learned a lot and I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
And here there is something more than just a transient experience.
It's about being. It's about the things that matter to me. It's about the white spaces between the paragraphs.
Then God said, "Let there be light."
The mistake you always made, Doc, trying to love a wild thing.